Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Have you sat back over the last 2 decades and thought about the sheer number of fatalities surrounding this case?
Can I tell you a secret?
That you've been killed.
What happened?
My whole brain's a bunch of missing pieces. That's when it all started. Panic.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching True Detective. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
We are a little over halfway through this season of Still Watching, where every week we break down the latest episodes, including theories and twists. This week we will be discussing and only spoiling up to season 3, episode 5, If You Have Ghosts, written and directed by Nick Pizzolatto. As we did last week, there will be maybe a little section at the end where we might talk about some stuff that is not a spoiler per se, but is perhaps considered something you might want to have a warning on before you wade into. But for the most part, we're just going to keep it to what we saw on the screen, as well as like what all the little Reddit detectives are working away with on online.
And we can't spoil it further because HBO did not give us more episodes.
It's true. We haven't seen anything past episode 5.
Yeah. Congratulations, listeners. You are now where we are. Like, we are all in the same place.
We are all on the same page with Stephen Dorff's recent hairline. Something I want to say is you're getting this episode a little early because HBO dropped the episode early on Friday instead of Sunday to sort of get out of the way of the Super Bowl. So it's available online as of Friday. So if you have this in your feed and you haven't watched the episode yet, you know, this is your warning. Are you caught up to episode 5? It dropped early. Go watch it before we start talking about it. All of that. Also in this episode, we've got an interview with great Scoot McNairy, or as Richard likes to call him,
McNairy, Queen of Scoots.
Yeah. So we will be talking to Scoot about his performance as Tom Purcell in this episode, which is actually something I really, really loved a lot about this episode. Before we get into all of that, we've got a few emails from you guys that we wanted to dive into. You can always email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us. Richard's at Rylaws. I'm at Joe Wrote This. Someone this week sent us a photo from a Fayetteville, Arkansas thrift store where they have a bunch of the jackets that were used on True Detective and maybe other things are on sale in like a rack that just says like as seen on True Detective. So if you want Stephen Dorff's like leather and tweed combo jacket or something like that, I think you might be able to find it at the Fayetteville thrift store. So go take a look. Our first email comes from Christian. And Christian just wanted to follow up on that, like that long ramble I had about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which once again, I sort of apologize for going off so long on that. But, Christian said, if this is a subject you find interesting, I highly recommend Gaspar Noé's Enter the Void. It's a surprisingly faithful narrative adaptation of that book and represents a distinctly Buddhist cosmology as opposed to Jacob's Ladder. And then Christian says he'll see us all for Game of Thrones in April. So, you know, thank you, Christian. I've seen other Gaspar Noé movies, but I've never seen Enter the Void. Have you seen that one, Richard?
No, I have not.
Okay. So, you know, Noé is sort of like a famously, he's a lot. His films are a lot. So if you're in the mood for a lot, you know, go check out that Enter the Void. We also got either a tweet or an email. I don't have it in front of me, but someone mentioned to me that they read The Things They Carried because we mentioned it, the Tim O'Brien book, because we mentioned it on the show. That makes me really happy because, oh no, it's this email from Marcos. Marcos says, I just want to comment on the bomb device that Brett Woodard sets up to explode if someone opens his front door. The one that says front toward enemy. I recognize this as a Claymore mine, a device used during the Vietnam War. I'm not a vet, but I know this from watching movies and reading books about the war. This makes sense because Brett, is a vet. Yeah. So just the kind of mine it is, the Claymore mine. And then Marco says, thanks for recommending Tim O'Brien's books. I just read The Thing They Carried and really enjoyed it. So yeah, if you're really interested in further exploring, there's a line that Wayne has in this episode, episode 5, where, he says Woodard made him carry his water. You know, that just made me think of The Things They Carried, which mm-hmm. is just, you know, about so much. So that's a great book. And then the last one comes from Jennifer from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Jennifer writes, though I'm not from Louisiana, my husband is and spent most of his life fishing in South Louisiana. Like most people in this region, sportsman paradise. Anyway, when the shoe pick lane sign came into frame on the first episode of season 3, my husband asked me to pause it and then told me that shoe peak is a junk fish, primitive, bony, with a flavorless meat like a garfish that can be caught on almost any bait because they'll eat anything. Wonder if that means anything here. Initially, I thought the street name served to describe their residence, but I did a little more research and discovered that when paired with the Hoyt theory, which is something we talked about last week in sort of the spoiler section, maybe Shoe Pick Lane is more significant. Referred to as a bowfin outside of Louisiana, shoe picks are commonly harvested for their roe to produce Cajun caviar. An undesired fish harvested for value eggs. Okay, I see you, Nick Pizzolatto, you clever little South Louisiana boy. So there we go. So those are some great emails we got. We will talk a little bit more about the Hoyt theory down in that spoiler section that I mentioned. And as we did last week, we will mark that off with a great, little new chicken noise alert that Dave put together for us. If you haven't heard it, it is something truly extraordinary. I think it's better even than the hog noises from, you know, sharp objects. So stay for the chicken noises, even if you don't stay for what comes after the chicken noises.
Should we also address, a somewhat glaring error we made last week? Regarding a mishearing of something.
Yes, you might have remembered a prolonged bit we did last week around the phrase grouper street kids, which both really reveals itself in this episode and anyone with watching with closed captioning that it was group of street kids. In our defense, I guess, this was during Mahershala's, you know, old man scene. And there were a few times where I had to like rewind scenes this week to rewatch them to hear sort of what he was mumbling about. So, in my slight defense, but the group of street kids bit, I don't know if it's dead. Just because it was wrong doesn't mean I don't want to hear Richard still continue to do a Color Me Bad Cockney sort of hybrid group of street kid bit. So we'll see.
I mean, the fact that we misheard it on the show doesn't mean that I wasn't in that band.
Oh, right. Of course. Right. Of course.
it's just not a coincidence anymore.
Do you have any thoughts about the episode title, if you have ghosts, other than like sort of the obvious one, which is that, you know, Wayne is continually haunted?
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, some of the titles, the episode titles kind of reveal their meaning as the episode goes. This one I feel like is a bit more opaque. But it's certainly this whole season is kind of building toward this very haunted thing. And I think particularly the closing scene of this episode, like this is a much more emotional season than we've seen in the past. I mean, there's definitely been emotion in True Detective before this, but like this feels very much about a friendship more than it does about a murder.
And yes.
So the so they're haunted by the murder, obviously, but there's also this kind of just like lost bond, I think, that that sort of really gets spoken about pretty eloquently in this episode.
Yeah, there's a phrase I guess there's a phrase, I didn't know it before this episode, but there's a phrase that is, if you have ghosts, you have everything, which means sort of like if you know where you came from, you know your roots, like if you have a history, you have something. And I think that parlays most directly to like Wayne is tortured in his own way. This older Wayne that we meet in 2015 is tortured in his own way because he has all these ghosts, but the ghosts at least mean like a life lived. And we meet older Roland in this episode where he talks about like, he never got married, never has kids. He lives out alone. He has no old friends. Like he has dogs. And so like, you know, Wayne has ghosts and that's like awful and torturous, but at least it's something. Whereas like maybe Roland has nothing at this point, which is a huge reversal for them. So, all right. We will get to that. We will get to Old Man Dorf, whom I love. So, we'll get to all of that, but we're going to start as we did last week, in chronological order. We're going to do 1980, 1990, 2015. Starting in 1980, we pick up, you know, directly where we left off with the explosion and the shootout at the Woodard compound. You know, FBI guys get hit, local, you know, rednecks get hit. Stephen Dorff gets hit in the shin. We find out where Roland got his limp. And then Wayne is sort of made to, Woodard basically makes Wayne kill him. In a scene that both, you know, great performance from Michael Gray as usual. And then also just great stuff from Mahershala. What did you think of this scene, Richard?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we talked about it last week that every season of this show so far has had a big action sequence. And here's this. And I think that like, you know, despite it being a big action sequence, it's pretty restrained, and I think that the chaos of it is used well for the broader narrative of the show. You know, like I think the kind of famous long take nighttime shootout thing in the first season of True Detective kind of ultimately felt like kind of beside the point. Like it wasn't a really like inherent part of the mystery in a way, but this, you know, is very much tangled up in it because this is how Woodard essentially gets blamed and is kind of held to be guilty for at least 10 years. So I like that it was both exciting and gory and scary, but also meant something.
Absolutely. And just this exchange between them, I really love that. Woodard calls him Sarge and Sergeant instead of Detective. You know, he calls him by like his war title, basically. And just this concept of like Wayne being so mad, like so frustrated that Woodard's gonna make him kill him when he doesn't like want to kill him, you know, is just, like a really, really interesting dynamic. This is where I want to mention, I can't remember if I mentioned it on the podcast, but Richard and I definitely talked about it briefly off air. The interesting connection between this scene and Jeremy Saulnier's film Hold the Dark, which I saw at Fantastic Fest last year. Jeremy Saulnier directed the first two episodes of the season. He was sort of like left the production somewhat acrimoniously. We don't know quite what happened, but he was supposed to direct the whole season. He only directed two episodes. I don't know the timeline here exactly of when Hold the Dark was made versus when the season was made, but Hold the Dark has an astonishingly similar shootout with a Native American man holed up in his like taking a stand with like a Gatling gun basically in the top of a like barn surrounded by cops, and then you've got like a main cop who's like sympathetic to this man's sort of plight and goes around the back and sneaks in the back and then has to like it's almost exactly the same. And so
you saying Maine cop made me wish that there was a True Detective season set in Maine. Can't get there from here.
I was Stephen, so hoping that Stephen would come King. With a Maine accent.
Stephen King does season 4 of True Detective, please.
I would love that. I'm going to write a little bit about this for our website. I'll have some like illustrative GIFs. If you know me, you know that that's something I like to do. So you can look for that on vanityfair.com. But I'm fascinated to know. I'm trying to see if anyone will talk to me about it, but I'm fascinated to know sort of the timeline on this and if you know it like which came first. How possibly these two things could exist that are so similar with a similar artist, but that artist wasn't there for this part of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So this episode was directed by Nick Pizzolatto. So
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You know, I don't know. Anyway, so we then go to Wayne in the hospital. He's worried about Roland, but there's nothing he can do. Amelia shows up as she always does when something happens. And she's like, saw it on the news. Tell me what happened. Tell me things. Tell me about it. But also like under the guise of wanting to help him. And like, as is often the case with Amelia, though this seemed to be initiated by Wayne, he's like, what do you smell like? She's like, ivory soap and chalk. He's like, let's go fuck. And they go have sex. And that, I mean, it's a way that it's a very believable to me thing, because I believe that this is a way that certain people handle, like, you know, trauma.
Sandra Bullock has a great monologue about that in the classic action film Demolition Man, in which she propositions Sylvester Stallone to have sex because she's like, that's how people deal with stress. But I think it's also, this is the first time in 1980 that they've slept together. Is that right?
So
it's not only that, but it's establishing something we've seen in the 1990 plotline previous to this episode, where this couple deals with conflict through the language of, you know, sexual intimacy, whether it's conflict between the two of them or if it's, you know, something from the broader world. Like they're sort of more most like potent language that they speak. Their most potent love language is sex. And I think that sort of furthers an already sort of interesting dynamic.
Is fighting and sex, conflict as a resolution. And so then the last thing we see in the 80s, I believe is, you know, it's connected to the 90s and the 2015s, but we see them processing the evidence at the Woodard home. There's a burnt sweatshirt found, in like a incinerator thing. There's Will's backpack under the floorboards, and we meet someone named Harris James, who, when an investigator on the scene pulls up the backpack, says, Harris got something here. And Harris is like, oh, that looks like the backpack of that missing boy from All Points. So, we find out later that, you know, we're trying to keep this clean chronologically, but it's hard to not relate this to other things. We find out later that Harris James, this guy on the scene here, died in 1990 when the case was reopened, or went missing at least. We find out that, in the 1990 plot, Wayne figures out that the backpack at least feels like it was planted because it's pristine condition, but under this, like, the deck of a house that's been blown up. So it should have been like damaged. And so it took them 3 days to process the scene. And so Wayne's theory is that anyone could have planted evidence there to incriminate Woodard. But, you know, if Woodard's dead and there's evidence on his property connecting him to Will and Julie, then, you know, as far as the 1980s cops are concerned or the district attorney, this is a case closed, right?
Yeah,
and
he's a reclusive person. He's a he's a native person, so he's got these kind of stigmas against him, and it just all gets so easily pushed into that narrative.
Right, and as they mentioned this episode, because he's dead, because Woodard's dead, there's no trial, so there's no like no defense probing deeply into this. It's just like, oh, found the stuff. He's dead. He's estranged from his family. Case closed. you know, which is, you know, understandable why they're digging back into the case now in the 1990s, which is what we're going to go to. Someone mentioned this, I forget where, maybe on Reddit, maybe in another chat that I was following, but they were like, okay, if they reopen the case in 1990 and there's even like a whiff that something went wrong in 1980, why would they ever put the same investigators on the case?
Right.
That's a really good point. That's a fair point. You know, obviously it's for the narrative, but, you know, procedure wise, Wayne and Roland probably would not be back on this case that, you know, was potentially mishandled in the 1980s, even if they're trying to exonerate their own investigation in the 1980s. That's something another, you know, IA would do or something like that. So, all right, so we get the Julie Purcell board.
Oh, wait, before we move on,
yeah,
we're assuming that's the end of 1980, right?
I think there's something else that they allude to. Maybe my memory will be jogged later in this episode. But I think we'll see a little bit more.
Oh, okay.
But not much more.
Yeah.
But that's very near the end of it, I think. All right, so we've got 1990, and certainly, like, if the case comes all together, we'll probably see some flashbacks to like what actually happened to Julie and Will, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, all right. So 1990, Julie Purcell sort of investigation board have a heyday, have fun, like freeze framing that. But you know, we get the 1990 team on the case. Roland is very insistent that like there not be an APB out, you know, just to protect Julie from anyone who might want to go after them. He also doesn't want to like, he doesn't want to put this in front of Tom because he doesn't want to upset Tom. And this goes to like Roland's personal connection with Tom. Another reason why Roland should not be on this case, but like his personal relationship that he has with Tom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite Roland's intentions, Tom blunders into the room anyway and is like, is that my daughter in there? Basically, except way better. Like Scoot does, is that my daughter in there, but like really well, I think. So what did you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing with this show or really anything where, you know, an actor of McNary, Queen of Scoots' stature, you know, who's, you know, he's not hugely famous, but he's kind of beloved by people who pay attention to this stuff. He gets cast on the show and you're like, I don't think he's just going to be the guy who's like, where are my kids? You know, like there's going to be more and here's more. And then at the end of the episode, there's even more. So this is kind of like the confirmation that like his aspect of the story is by no means concluded and is kind of ever evolving along with everything else. So I like that because I think he's a great actor.
This is a perfect time to go to our interview with Scoot McNary.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic.
Okay, so we're talking about episode 5. You have basically 3 scenes of extreme grief in this episode, you know, finding out that Julie might still be alive, holding the press conference, and then listening to this recording towards the end of the episode. I'm wondering specifically about that recording scene. Did you have the audio of what was going to play, or did you have to react to, I don't know, just a tape recorder, a blank tape recorder in front of you?
You know, it's so funny that you asked that. It was, I think it was Nick's assistant or one of the producer's assistants that laid down a tape. But, you know, they played it on the speaker in the room. But you could really hear the room tone noise on the speaker. So, you know, the room is incredibly quiet. It was a tiny little box. So, yeah, I did have somebody speaking to me to react to it or a recording, I guess, to react to it, but every time it stopped, like this ambient noise would stop. It stopped as well, and then it would just get dead quiet. And, you know, having you just said that to me, it just brought back that memory.
So often actors talk about the energy, you know, they get from their various scene partners, you know, and obviously you're not the first actor to have to react to something more passive or static, but, you know, what tricks do you have sort of in your tool belt when it comes to doing something like that, where you're just listening to something and having to go through a gamut of emotion?
I will say I have kids, and, you know, I sort of put myself in sort of awful position of putting myself in Tom Purcell's position as to what would it be like if this happened to my kids. And it was as much as I enjoyed doing the project and working on such a great script and all mixed writing, it was I won't lie to you, it was a really awful place for me to sit in for 5 months, and I was very, very, very relieved when it was over. And shit, my heart goes out to anyone and everyone that's ever had to deal with any sort of circumstance like this. It's, I can see how it's something that we just could just never really ever recover from. And
given how sort of grim and harrowing these kinds of stories can be, what do you think feeds our national or maybe even international obsession with true crime, with our compulsion to live in these worlds of tragedy, of murder, of mystery?
I think it's our reality. I think we're fascinated by it because it's true. It really does happen. You look at these sort of neighborhoods or societies that are sort of these utopias, and it's almost in a way scary to live in those because they're so far removed from the world that we actually live in. And I think that sort of what sparks our fascination with it is that we know these things happen, but to actually watch them happen and see the details of how they happened and, working of them, it's fascinating. I mean, me personally probably watched about 550 episodes of Forensic Files. I don't know what keeps bringing me back to them, but I can watch them back to back to back to back.
I don't know if you know this, but in the betting markets right now, Tom Purcell is currently, like, odds are on Tom to be the killer this season. Did you ever get a note from any of your directors, Daniel, Nick, Jeremy, that you were acting too squirrely, too guilty, that you needed to dial it back? Or do you just play the truth of Tom as you see it?
Yes, I go on. I really didn't want to know if Tom did it or didn't do it. If I didn't know, then I would assume that the audience wouldn't know. And I think, obviously, that's a very important piece to Nick's writing and the script and the performance.
So you're saying, like, from the scripts you got, it was ambiguous to you, and then you would prefer not to know the concrete answer until you were done, or?
From the scripts I got, I felt both. I felt like, did he do this? But no, he couldn't have done this. You know what I mean? But
yeah,
but he might, but he could have. And so I sort of gotten just enough information for me to sort of move forward on a day-to-day basis. But I didn't want to know the last episode. I did not want to know how it ends. I didn't read it. I didn't want to know. I also didn't want to know so that I would be excited to watch the show as well, not knowing how it ended.
Right. There's this one scene you have in the car with Steven's character, Roland, where Tom uses a racial epithet when talking about Wayne, Mahershala Ali's character, and then expresses this genuine, just really deeply felt emotional remorse for using that terrible word. And I'm wondering, it was a surprising, I think, reaction. While I was watching, I was surprised that Tom had such a strong reaction. What was it like for you to film that scene?
It's actually hard for me to talk about that scene. I think every character, I don't know how all actors work, but every character I feel like I play is 50% me and 50% this character, and I try not to lose the sense of self in playing character or project self into character. That whole, and what this country's going through right now, is something that's very personal to me and very frustrating to me. And I felt like we had come so far, since those times that I think that scene becomes across so genuine because it's so frustrating that we're back to that place now. And I have so much sort of anger and animosity towards racist people. Everybody feels the same thing. Everybody gets jealous. Everybody gets hurt. Everybody has the same emotions. And there's a part of that that's giving Tom humanity and having Tom grow as a human being to realize that those thoughts and ideas are irrelevant when it comes down to losing a child, as if someone who is white that loses a child is worse than somebody who's black, or trying to separate the two. And I felt like at that moment, it's more of Tom sort of learning that, like, if you lose a kid, nothing else matters, and everybody else experiences this pain, whether you're black, white, any color or race or religion. It's, we're all human beings.
I think you really see that in the watching you play Tom 10 years apart and watching you play Tom so out of control in the 80s and then so like clinging to these structures of control like religion or routine in the 90s. And then maybe seeing that all unravel again as he's like, thrown back into this question of Julie and all of that. You're the first of the actors on the show that have played in multiple timelines that I've talked to. So I'm wondering, do you get to shoot that in order? And how do you, modulate that performance of 80s Tom and 90s Tom?
This guy has really, really, really worked hard over the course of 10 years to overcome this tragedy and this loss, to sort of pick himself up, back up and rebuild himself and uses religion to do so. I don't think it's been revealed yet, but there's other demons within even him taking on religion that he has to deal with, that is coming up, that the detectives make a discovery that has a conflict in him even being religious. I can't really elaborate on that, but it's just and it's mixed writing that makes him sort of prevail and overcome. But within the overcoming, he's still dealing with a demon that we didn't. Not even a demon. I shouldn't even say that. It's not a demon. It's a secret that he's dealing with that juxtaposes his religion.
And then on a slightly more frivolous note, I'm wondering if you get any say at all as the actor in crafting like what Tom's look in the 80s versus Tom's look in the 90s will be. There's so much wig work in this series, and I think you got away with not having to do a wig. You just got to comb your hair back, I think. But do you get any input on that front?
It's always a collaboration. I have my thoughts and my ideas. A lot of characters I play, I like to go out and find the external part of them as a real person. And this particular character, I found this guy in small town Texas. I was getting my car washed. I watched him for a really long time in my car. I was taking pictures of him. And I sent that to Brian, the hair. And I said, I think this is the guy. I think this is what he looks like. And he was like, I love it. I think it's great. And that was it. When I got there, my hair is naturally curly, and I always sort of try to comb it out. And I had an idea, I had a thought. I sent him a bunch of pictures of this guy from the car wash. And, I wanted him to look like a stray, lost puppy sheepdog.
I love the idea that anyone like out in the world at any given moment could be having their picture taken by Scoot McNairy and be the basis for a character in an upcoming project.
Well, I just find it, my wife, I have photographs of random people that I've taken pictures of, like this catalog of characters that I think are interesting looking. Or, you see somebody like, I wonder what that guy's wife is like, or I wonder what his apartment looks like, or his house, or, just the mystery behind the facade of somebody is fascinating to me, and I'll never get to go to their apartment or their house, but the fantasizing about what it's like is one of my favorite parts of being an actor.
You're like an actor detective, kind of.
Kind of.
And then my last question for you, I guess, is if you can talk about it, I don't know, maybe it's something we haven't seen yet, so maybe you can't talk about it, but like, what was the hardest, you know, scene for you to film? What was the most challenging?
When he, it was just a total wonderment if he's going to find his daughter again. And just like, and if he's not, at the moment, it was like, because if we're not, I just want to move on with my life. I can't live like this, not knowing if she's dead or not dead. And that was something that was, it's, in the end, it's still sits with me today. And, you know, and I haven't seen the show yet. I'm in Mexico City, so we don't have HBO Go down here that it works. But that specific scene is every, you know, whenever I think about my time in Arkansas, my time on this job and this character, that's the one that just keeps popping back into my head.
It's like we find out a few details, like Lucy died in 88. You know, Dan, they can't find him. The last they saw him, he was in Vegas, 85, 87, dropped off the map. So cousin Dan, still on the loose, but we know from previous episodes that they will find him at some point in 1990 before he ends up dead in a quarry. So that's the timeline on that. And then, you know, like we get this press conference, right? Where Tom, as played by Scoot, is in front of camera sort of pleading for Julie, to come back. We also get, Attorney General Kent on this press conference. And I think that's really important for the later. I'll just do all the Tom stuff really quickly, right? So like Tom does his press conference. Kent is also on camera talking about it. And then he gets interrupted by Alan, who's there with Woodard's kids. And this fills in some holes we've been hearing throughout the season where they're like the man, his kids. We now know that the man is Brett Woodard. The kids who want to reopen the case are these two kids, that we meet here. David and Josie Woodard, who want their father cleared. And I love this moment when Wayne says to Alan, where was this Perry Mason shit in the 80s? Because I don't know if you ever watched Perry Mason. I watched a lot of Perry Mason. I watched a lot with my mom, like all the time when I was very young. And Perry, like, this is how I thought court cases would go, is that there would be like cross-examination of the Perry Mason's, like, it wasn't her, it was him, and pointing to like someone who's just like in the room and just going like way off procedure and going rogue. And so him calling what Alan does here Perry Mason shit is really perfect.
I like it when Wayne's funny.
Yeah, for the Perry heads out there, for the Mason addicts. So this is an interesting press conference and Alan's sort of like stunt and all of this. What do you think of this?
It's nice to have stuff kind of click into place, you know, and you know, because to have it be confirmed that this is the person we're talking about in terms of who was, you know, wrongly convicted and all that. I like the show moving along. I like that this episode is good in terms of like churning out exposition, but in an interesting way, and you know, setting us up nicely for the back half of the season, or like less than a half of the season. I like when Wayne's funny, and I like where the mystery is taking us.
And it's also important to see sort of where Alan and Kent are using their own political motivations,
right,
in this, that like, you know, Alan has his own personal vendetta going on here, or his own agenda, I should say. And then let's hop to the end of Tom's little thread and say that off the back of that press conference, they've set up a hotline. Someone calls in. It's a young woman claiming to be Julie, or she never says she's Julie, but you know, and this is literally what she says. She says, I saw him on the television, make him leave me alone. Tell him to leave me alone. I know what he did. The man on TV acting like my father. Where's my brother Will? I don't know what he did with him. We left him resting. He took me and I'm never coming back. Just leave me alone. And Tom is listening to all this and crying. And then he like turns to Roland and he goes, Lieutenant West, Roland. And like further sort of underlining Tom's personal connection with Roland and how it's sort of muddying the case. Looking back at this, watching this a second time, it's like very, this is another case of the show pulling that trick similar to the man and his kids that we just found out exactly who they were this episode, she maybe is not talking about Tom in this recording.
Right, exactly. 'Cause
like, I think she's talking about Kent.
Yeah.
This is when I start to suspect Attorney General Kent. Maybe Alan, but I think it's Kent. And that puts Kent on like the high on the suspect to be involved in this whole thing board for me.
Yeah. No, totally. And because it's so deliberately vague. I saw him on TV, So I think there has been a frustrating, just a kind of fun amount of misdirection in this season, in terms of pointing us towards the teenagers and the West Memphis Three, and then pointing us maybe toward Amelia. And then now it's sort of like, oh no, like, but those politician-y, lawyer-y guys that have been on the periphery since the first episode actually are sort of, you know, could be crucial to the story in a sort of more central way than just being kind of side characters who help our lead detectives kind of, you know, have an excuse to give us the facts, you know?
And this is very Pizzolatto that it would be like someone high up in the ranks of somewhere, right? Being involved. And actually a listener wrote in this theory very early in the season. So, you know, I'm sorry I don't have the email in front of me, but like shout out to them for, someone I think pointed to Kent early in the season. And, I'm not saying he acted alone, and actually we'll talk about this a little bit more after you hear the chicken sounds on this episode, but thinking about Kent in this way, he's very motivated to not question the Woodard conviction back in 1980. And we thought that was maybe like to preserve his own reputation or, you know, just to be like, it will make me look bad if we fuck this up in the 80s. But what if he's actually guilty in it and it serves him in another way to make sure that everyone thinks it's Woodard, right?
Right.
And then there's also things like a set of fingerprints go missing in this episode when Wayne's looking for them. And like, that seems like it needs to be someone inside the force. And then also the planted evidence, like maybe this person, Harris James, who goes missing is part of that, but maybe Kent is part of that too. You know, so like somebody, Harris James, you know, this investigator, Harris James, this officer, and Kent are somehow involved in all of this. I feel very, very good about that theory. So
yeah, totally. And playing Kent is the actor Brett Cullen, who's great, and he's been on, you know, a bunch of TV shows. He's in Dark Knight Rises, but he did four episodes of Lost, so he's not a stranger to a mystery. And I don't know. I don't think he would be cast unless he had maybe a higher purpose to serve. But we'll see.
Yeah, we mentioned that in the beginning. I think when we were like picking out all the actors who were like, oh, and this person, we were like, this guy we've seen in so many things. So, there you go. So the Kent theory arises, I guess. And so,
so instead of an Easter egg, it's a Kinder egg.
a little German for our friends. All right. So, so then we've got some other things that happen in the 1990s as Wayne and Roland are on the case. They go see Freddie Burns, who increasingly to me just feels like a red herring, right?
Oh, totally.
So, but I did talk to Michael Gray Eyes, on the podcast last week in our interview about the collateral damage of this case. 'Cause there's like, Eliza keeps bringing it up in the 2015 storyline. The documentary director, she's like, it's amazing how many people are dead. Cool. Around this case, you know, and we see a lot of that in this shootout at the Woodard, property, but, you know, Brett Woodard, because suspicion fell on him, is collateral damage. Freddie Burns, I mean, Wayne makes the case that Freddie Burns' life would be terrible anyway without that interrogation scene we saw last week, but like, you know, Freddie's carrying trauma from his, interaction with this case. And once again, I think that's a red herring, but it's worth visiting, I think. So.
Yeah. And it's interesting seeing Wayne, because, you know, we've seen him as an old kind of doddering man. We've seen him fall in love. Like, we're sympathetic to him. We like him. I like him, you know? And then, but for him to kind of deny his impact on other people, to accuse an entire generation of being, you know, cowards.
Pussies.
Or I didn't want to say the word, but
I know.
you know, then it's kind of like, oh, he's being a shithead. Like he's you know, he has flaws too. So I just appreciate that they that Pizzolatto and the other writers like have I guess it would just be David Mills, right? But are conscious to round him out, you know, and not make him this kind of like, you know, idyllic hero.
Yeah. And we, and this scene is not just for that, because we also get a tiny piece of evidence, which is, Freddy saying they, like,
yep.
Like that he saw Will. Will was looking for his sister and he said they. So just like not where she or like he, but like maybe that a couple people took Julie, right? Which puts Roland and Wayne back on the who were Julie and Will playing with in the woods beat, which is something honestly that really should have been deeply investigated in the 80s. And that's why Wayne was looking for those fingerprints off the toys, but they've gone missing.
Yeah,
so,
I guess that does point to a slight, I don't know, credibility gap in the show's kind of conception, is that like, I don't really believe that in 1980, Wayne and maybe even Roland would have been like, okay. I mean, obviously, if they're taken off a case, they're taken off a case. Like, and everyone says case closed, like it's settled, like no more investigating it. You kind of have to abide by that. But like, it, I don't know, this sort of new sense of discovery about like, you know, with the case reopened, it's like, I feel like that those things would have been gnawing at them more than we've seen.
Well, I think that's why Wayne got put on like desk duty since the 1980s. I think that whole thing of like he was not, that's why I think we'll see more of the 1980s, because like he wasn't satisfied with leaving the case there.
Right.
And Roland played ball with it, and that's how Roland got ahead and
right.
Wayne got shunted over desk duty. And if Kent is involved in this, like the idea of like punishing and isolating Wayne from being able to continue to investigate the case serves him, right?
In
the 80s. So I think you're both right, but like maybe that's something we're going to see more of, possibly. And then we get the Gruber Street kids. We get this one street kid comes in, like comes forward to say like he knows Julie. Julie used to run with him, or this woman. I at the end of this episode, I'm convinced that that is Julie, right? Okay. So She goes by Mary July. She's a little nutty. She can't get straight on what year is. She says she's a secret princess from the Pink Rooms, that she lost a brother looking for her brother. They got pulled apart when she was young. And then he writes down some names of like other people who might lead them to Julie. The Pink Rooms and Secret Princess really relates to Julie's drawings that we've seen in the first few episodes. She's got all these drawings of like her as a princess. And there's also one which like, there's one particular drawing that looks like a room that we're going to see at some point. It's got like drawers and like all, you know, it's like, it's a real place that Julie's been to that I think will be a hint. And I thought it was like Amelia's kitchen or something like that, but I think we kind of see Amelia's kitchen in this episode and it's not that. So you know, this idea that maybe Julie was taken, told she was a secret princess, taken and held, and then escaped, maybe, you know, maybe this is some sort of like room scenario, escaped, and you know, was like, fuck you Kent, fuck you whoever was working with him, like I'm one of the Gruber Street kids now or whatever. Like she becomes a runaway because she runs away from the people who took her. And this is why, and this is why Wayne is right to be worried about people knowing that Julie might be back,
right?
Because it might be in their best interest, it might be in Kent's best interest to try to eliminate her if he is involved.
And this whole stuff with Pink Rooms and being a princess, it's like sort of vaguely evocative of the Yellow King from the first season. Like, I don't know.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, he likes a sort of trope like that.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, we don't know. I mean, I think you brought this up last week, but we don't know who Julie's real father is. Like, that was another vague pronoun-ish thing used in 2015. What happened with Julie and her father? Not Julie and Tom.
Right.
So, like, what happened with Julie and her father could be, like, if Lucy had sex with, like, it could be Kent. It could be, someone else. You know what I mean? But, like, that, you know, he might actually be her biological father. We don't know. But, that's just something to keep an eye on. So, there we go. So, and then we get, a lot of Amelia stuff in this episode, which, like, if we weren't already on the, like, Kent scent right now, would be very, I think, evocative of Amelia being involved, because, you know, Amelia and Wayne go have dinner with Roland and Lori, who we met last week's episode. Oh, I should say really quickly, someone sent me the betting odds, people betting on who was involved, who killed Will or whatever. And top of the charts, like odds highest in favor of, is Tom and Lori.
Why Lori?
I don't know. I think Lori is maybe one of those, like, people think that because, you know, as we mentioned last week, like, Jodie Balfour, the actor who plays her, is, like, not a nobody. So, like, do you just have – not – she's not, like, a star, but she's not a nobody. So, like, is Lori in here sort of thing. I don't know. As people are high on Lori doing it. So, there you go.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I don't agree with it at all. But, you know, I just thought it was funny. All right. So unless I misunderstood betting odds and actually like the reverse is true, you guys let me know if I don't understand what betting, how betting odds work.
Yeah. When Joanna bets, she only does the penny slots. So she's,
it's true. but you know, the big takeaway from the scene is like, you know, a couple things that, you know, that they're not married. Maybe Roland has some like commitment issues, things that seem very consistent with sort of his alpha male-ish 90s character that he's playing here. Amelia wanting to bring her book over for them to look at. Amelia being very curious in the case. Wayne being really pissed, first about like her telling the Salazar cops that he was her ex-husband, and also just like her talking about it. And Amelia being sort of pissed that Roland is doing so well and they aren't, that their house is sort of shitty compared to Roland's, which is, I think, where you got this idea that like maybe Amelia did this to like get ahead, like that she wants this kind of success in her life as part of it. They have a fight. It's another like real, I could really watch Carmen Ejogo and Mahershala Ali fight all the time. Like, I don't know if the dialogue always carries them, but like, you know, 10 years and you never got me right. Or like, he calls her a voyeur, lifting yourself up on their bad luck. Like all this sort of stuff. It's just, they really chew into this stuff. So
yeah, and then there's some good writing in these scenes. Like, I love, Wayne saying gifts shouldn't flatter the giver. Like that's a great sort of, I mean, also kind of like a good, you know,
life lesson,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. but yeah, I mean, I don't know that the sort of Amelia stuff felt furthered here. I don't know. I just think that like, regardless of whether or not Amelia is actually sort of, you know, has a broader role to play in the coming episodes, like, I just think this is a really interestingly drawn relationship and, you know, like you said, really well acted.
Yeah. And then it ends with, you know, little Becca is sick and it ends with them all sort of all piled in the bed. There's, you know, the one disadvantage to us going through this chronologically is that, you know, we don't get this, we can't maybe fully dig into this fun cutting back and forth they get, but there's just this really good and upsetting moment where Wayne is walking up the stairs behind little Becca, little Henry and Amelia to this cozy domestic, you know, destination where they're all going to pile in the bed together and read the Jungle Book. And they vanish and we're in 2015 in the same house. And he's like, where's my family? And it's not just like, it's not just like the dementia, which is hard to watch. It's just sort of like, yeah, to go from being like surrounded by so much to having nothing is such a tragedy. Which we'll see echoed through Roland in 2015, but it's just like, that's one of the harshest flashes I think we've seen. And then it's just the most, sort of chewiest journey we get through the timelines because we see 2015 Wayne watching 1990 sort of Wayne holding hands with Amelia reading the Jungle Book. And then we see 1990s Wayne look in the window and see 1980s Wayne spattered in blood and in the hospital. So it's just sort of like this little thread through in this particular scene here.
Yeah. I think that whole like, where's my family thing is so devastating. Like, you know, kind of a tangent, but my parents are probably going to leave my childhood home and like move somewhere else soon. And part of me is sad about it, but it's also like, yeah, like go do something new that's not like haunted by like the past and like, you know, like the ghostly laughter of children or whatever. Like, it, you know, I just felt so badly. I felt so bad for Wayne in that scene. It was just, you know, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. It's really sad. All right. So, I think that's all the 90s stuff we're going to cover unless there's anything else.
No, I think that's about it.
Yeah. Then we get to 2015. And this is where Eliza basically says, like, one of the officers who processed the Woodard case, the Woodard scene, Harris James, went missing during the 1990 investigation. Wayne pretends and he doesn't know who Harris James is, but like obviously he does, like, and she says you talk to him. So we'll see, in theory, Wayne and possibly Roland talking to Harris and possibly killing him and putting him in the woods. I don't know. Like, Wayne muttered in a previous episode, like, that thing we left in the woods. So mm-hmm. like maybe it's Harris James's body.
Yeah.
And they killed him, possibly. I want to return to that ghost scene we saw in last week's episode where you and I sort of debated whether or not all those ghosts that were crowding around 2015 Wayne in his study were people he had killed. I watched it again right before we recorded. And I'm going to go back to saying I think it is, because what I missed the first time is there's a very brief shot of Woodard with a bullet wound in his forehead. So like Woodard is one of the people that Wayne killed. You're right that not every, like soldier in that scene looks like has like a straw hat on and stuff like that. But like, I think it's possible that these are all people that Wayne killed. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy, I mean, you don't get to see his face and his hair is kind of slicked down. So you can't tell like if it's gingery or not, but like, I would bet money that that's Harris James in that ghost scene with a bullet wound in his chest, yeah. Who was killed in 1990 sometime. So there we go. And we get a scene of Wayne reading, Amelia's book.
Yeah, he's like, baby, I should have read this so long ago. You're like, you idiot.
Once again, that's like a convenient thing to us that Wayne is only just now reading the book. But this reminds me of a discussion we had when we were doing Sharp Objects, where at the very end you get to hear the article that the lead character is a journalist, a great writer, and or a whatever writer in that show has written. Mm-hmm. And like a character reads it out and then it's like, oh, that's genius. And we're like, oh, it's so hard to like read out prose that a character has written and for us to like believe his genius. And so like he's reading out Amelia's book and I'm like, this is very overrated.
It does not sound like the seminal crime book no. of this era. Yeah.
It's very purpley. So I'm not sure. But yeah, a mutable something, soul grief, indistinguishable from madness. All right, Amelia. Anyway, so Amelia, in the section he's reading, she describes her encounter with Lucy that we saw in a previous episode. And he makes, Wayne in 2015 makes a connection between Lucy telling Amelia children should laugh, you know, and the ransom note saying children should laugh. And so Wayne's conclusion seems to be that like Lucy did it. Or Lucy wrote the ransom note or something like that. So, that's a question mark that we can pursue a little bit later on if we want to. But first,
I feel like they kind of make that clear cut that she did the ransom note just to sort of, because it was a phrase she used. Like, I feel like that felt sort of settled to me.
I disagree, but we're going to talk about it after the chicken noises. Okay. So, then we get, Old Man Dorf. I actually, because I hadn't been watching the previews and, so I didn't know whether or not we were going to get Old Man Dorf. But cause like I didn't know if Roland was alive or whatever. But here he is feeding his dogs in the middle of nowhere, putting booze in his coffee, teaching a small dog how to get ladies. I think Steven Dorf is fantastic. I think his makeup looks great. What do you think of this intro?
Oh, yeah, he looks great. I mean, it's not as effective as Mahershala Ali's old man makeup, nor Mahershala Ali's really expert body language. I think that his physical bearing, when he pulls up to Roland's house, we see Wayne kind of like pulling himself out of the car. And it's like a lot. It's a really good bit of physical acting for a shot that's from very far away, you know? So Dorf can't compete with that, but I still like it. And I love what he does in this. I mean, it's not one soul scene because it's chopped up, but like, I love what he does in this sequence. I think it's so well acted and really, really nicely deepens the kind of emotional register of the season.
Yeah. I agree with you that it's not as, I just believe that Mahershala Ali is however old he's meant to be in 2015. And with Steven Dorf, I'm like, that's a very convincing performance, but I don't get lost in it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They also put like, he has the disadvantage of like, they put like a little pillow on him under his undershirt. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, it doesn't look as good as like whatever like subtler thickening they've done to Mahershala Ali's body and stuff like that. He did do one pull up. There's one point where he gets up out of his chair to like throw a ball for his dogs while he's talking to Wayne. And he did do that sort of like, ugh, my joints sort of thing. In a way that I was like, okay. But yeah, so we learn some things. We learn that they haven't talked since 90 or 91. It's been 24, 25 years. We learn Roland never got married, never had kids, was once a very sociable person and lives alone. And so like whatever happened in 1990 genuinely seems to have like ruined Roland's life. Like that his life was on an upswing from 80 to 90. And then like whatever happened in 90 led him here to be drinking a lot in the middle of nowhere, to be frightened to this case. And something happened between the two of them. Not just that, like, possibly they killed a guy, but, you know, like, Roland asks Henry, does he remember why I'm mad at him? And Henry's like, it's not worth it. And then Roland says this amazing thing where he's like, maybe I forgot myself. You know, it's just like so much time has passed. Oh, and my favorite, to go back to your thing about this being about friendship, my favorite shot of the episode is like Wayne gets out. He's talking to Henry. He's like, I'm not sure I want to go in. I don't know. Roland comes out. Makes some joke where he like pretends that Henry is Wayne. And then Mahershala gets this just like delighted look on his face. Like, hey, it's my old friend. And he's making jokes. It's like heartbreaking and sweet and just such a calibrated, performance of like someone older laughing at a joke that's like kind of corny and basic, but like is just delighted by it, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, it's just a great, I really like it. And I like this kind of like, I don't know, like this would be a movie with Michael Douglas and Morgan Freeman, like two old guys getting back on the, you know, back on the hunt. Like, but it's done in such a non-cliche way somehow. Yeah, I think it's great. I love Stephen Dorff, and he has the tear rolling down his eye.
I actually wrote down a Morgan Freeman line from Shawshank Redemption when like, Red says in Shawshank Redemption, like, maybe I just miss my friend.
Yeah.
Talking about Andy. Which gets me every time. That's what I wrote down in my notes when he was like, when Wayne gives that look where he's just like so excited. We get a dump of more information, like Roland being worried that Eliza he does not want to be part of the docuseries. He's afraid everything's going to get pinned on them somehow, like killing a man. The director showed a new picture. They talk about Dan O'Brien's body found in the quarry and Harris James, this guy, this investigator who went missing. And then they connect that to Lucy somehow. Roland says,
she had a connection to him or something like that, right? Or we know he had a connection to her.
We already know she had some connection to that guy whose name you just said, which is a classic True Detective season 3. We're going to be vague about which guy. So it's either Cousin Dan or Harris James. And my money would be on Harris. Dan feels like another red herring to me, to be honest with you. And so we already knew she had connection to that guy whose name you just said. And then Wayne says he came to see me, that Hoyt came to see him the day after it happened. So maybe the day after they killed someone, Hoyt, who remember is the guy who owns Hoyt Foods, where the chicken line is, came to see them and Roland didn't know that. Hoyt knew about what they had done. So maybe that they had killed someone. And basically like Wayne is like, let's do this. And Roland's like, no. Wayne says yes. And literally they go, yes and no, yes and no, yes and no. Like stir some shit up with me. Come do this. Roland has a great line about old man fantasy camp.
Mm-hmm.
And this concept of killing time, which is a phrase we use a lot just casually, but just thinking about that notion of like, I've become a master in killing time. Like that's just, that has a heavier sort of significance in the context of this thing. And basically Roland convinces Wayne, as you say, to do the Michael Douglas Morgan Freeman movie with him. The old dogs, the bucket list, like we're back on the case. Here we go. So, this introduces, I would guess, like the back wave of the season. We talked about sort of pivoting from the 80 investigation to the 90 investigation. Now here's the 2015 investigation, right?
Yeah.
So there we go.
And I think I like it. I think that the season is sort of elegantly shaped. It's kind of like a wave, you know, and we're now moving into the kind of the crest, which is, you know, in the third part of the triptych. And, you know, initially that kind of the sort of three part structure kind of bothered me, and I worried that people would be confused. And I have heard from some kind of more casual watchers that they are a little bit confused. But like, I think standing back a little bit in aggregate, I think it so far is working really well.
Yeah, I think it's like Westworld season two, where like if you're doing a podcast about it and rewatching episodes, like it can be really interesting to like track these timelines. But I can't imagine watching this casually, like especially if you can't nail the difference between Wayne's 90s haircut and his 80s haircut.
Right.
It's like it's a challenge. So there you go. All right. So I want to get into connecting some of the threads of various theories that we've popped up so far this season, but we're gonna do that after our like chicken sound. Is there anything else? The chicken sounds, and then you know what you signed up for after it. Is there anything, Richard, that you want to talk about before we get there?
Do you think that the thing, the rift between Wayne and Roland is because they kissed and it was awkward after?
Yeah, and then Amelia was like, "Do it more. I'm gonna get the video camera."
I need a sequel. Yeah.
Yeah. This is to your point, I like this episode. I love the introduction of 2015 Roland, and I love the crystallization of what this season seems to really be about, which is a friendship, which is something that season one, you know, with Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, like that relationship and how it dissolved over the years, was such a key part of season one. And then they kind of lost that. They definitely lost that in season two. So to bring that back, cause we talked about collateral damage earlier, collateral damage to Freddie, to Brett, but collateral damage to Roland, to Wayne, and to their friendship, which, you know, above the Wayne and Amelia relationship is the one I'm most invested in this season. So there you go. It's chicken time.
Everything you touch turns to shit.
All right. So here's my unified theory. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Lay it on me.
So last week in this section, we talked about the Hoyt theory. The Hoyt theory, if you missed it last week, is based off a shot that was in a listener sent the source to me. It's, HBO did a filming in Arkansas little video where it's just like the actors talking about how fun it was to film in Arkansas. And that shot, there's a shot in that video that HBO released of the cave, Devil's Den, and the camera pans to a woman in white who looks to be identical to a portrait of a woman in white that was in the Hoyt Foods office that we visited a couple episodes ago. And so the theory is that Hoyt's daughter, whose own daughter went missing, and that's why they have a charitable children's foundation, that Hoyt's daughter wanted to take Julie Purcell to raise as her own, to replace her own missing daughter. And this mention of Hoyt in this episode, Hoyt came to see us, seems to really further cement that the fact that the Hoyts might be involved somehow. So here's a theory. Either Hoyt himself or Kent acting for Hoyt or Kent acting with, Hoyt's daughter approached Lucy and asked to buy her children. And Lucy said yes. Cause if you rewatch, if you believe that theory, either Kent actually is Julie's father. Cause like I could definitely see Julie, like, you know, having sex with, I mean, Lucy, played by Mamie Gummer, having sex with Kent. That could have happened. Maybe Kent could be Julie's actual father or not. But at any rate, the idea that Lucy might sell her kids does sort of seem like something she might do. And maybe Dan was involved in that somehow. Maybe Dan like helped broker the deal or something like that, because if you rewatch that scene between Mamie Gummer and Carmen Ejogo in the episode where she says children should laugh, she talks about like what I'd done and killing herself. So like my idea is that like maybe Lucy was convinced because she doesn't care about her children and she wants money, right? Mm-hmm. To sell her children. But never expected that one of them would die. Like maybe convince herself I'm giving them a better life. They'll be better off. This is an unhappy home. They'll be better off. They'll be with rich people. But then like Will shows up dead and that makes Lucy feel so guilty for what she did. So like Lucy writing the note or they told her children should laugh was like their, way of convincing her to get rid of Will and Lucy. To Will and Julie. Sorry, I keep confusing Julie and Lucy. Anyway, so that's a theory. Kent being involved seems very certain to me. Hoyt being involved and Hoyt's daughter being involved feels very certain to me. But this idea that maybe like Julie was taken to replace the Hoyt granddaughter that went missing and was kept in a room. Maybe Hoyt, who owns the company, doesn't know about it. Maybe this is just the particular mania of his daughter and he doesn't know that his daughter has done this and put this little girl in a room. Or maybe he does. But, and the idea that maybe, Whitehead, who was the like African American suspect who was pushing back on being questioned was maybe part of it too, because we have all these reports of a nice brown car, a white woman and a black man with a dead eye all being involved. So the suspects in this conspiracy, which goes all the way up to the top of industry and the top of, you know, the attorney general's office is Kent, Hoyt, Hoyt's daughter, this, you know, question mark black man.
Yeah, that feels very Pizzolatto, doesn't it?
It really does.
Like, that's pretty credible. Although, I guess, you know, I think that's a pretty persuasive theory. I do kind of think, though, that it would sort of reduce Amelia just to, like, the kind of hectoring wife character that I was hoping she wasn't. Even though she's like involved and she has her book and everything, you know, I don't really know what that necessarily means in terms of like its intrinsic weight to the story. And that's maybe why I was kind of telegraphing that, oh, I think Amelia did it, because I was like, she has to be there for a bigger reason, you know. But maybe she's not.
My friend Lindsay Romaine, who is really into like true crime and true detective, who writes over for Nerdist, she has really hated the Amelia theory because she feels like she feels the opposite. She feels like it does reduce Amelia to another kind of I don't know if it's a female stereotype, but the comparison I've heard a lot is to Michelle McNamara, who is Patton Oswalt's late wife, who basically, the cops had given up on finding the Golden State Killer, and she's a true crime writer, and she like basically figured out who it was by like refusing to let the case go. Something that Lindsay said to me was this idea of like Amelia, and we see in this episode Lori at the dinner table. Maybe they're like intuitive. This is another stereotype anyway, but like intuitive, emotional, female sort of inquisitiveness, is pushed aside in the face of like these men are in charge of the case, and sort of like maybe they would have been more on the right track if they had been allowed to, like maybe Amelia would have figured out who it was. Maybe she was more on the right track than anyone else to go talk to Lucy, like all this sort of stuff. And so, I think it will depend on how the rest of the Amelia story like unwinds. I can see it going both ways. I can see it landing exactly as you say, Richard, especially because True Detective hasn't always been great with his treatment of women. And I could see it maybe going the way that my friend Lindsay hopes it will go, which is that like, if only Wayne had listened to Amelia, maybe he would have figured this out decades ago, sort of thing. So I don't know. But we shall see. The last piece of evidence I would give for this whole Lucy Kent Hoyt theory is that Mamie Gummer both told me that she only got the scripts that pertain to her scenes, and also told me she knows how this whole story goes. So, it, you know, whereas Michael Gray has told me in the interview last week, he only got the scripts that pertain to a scene and he doesn't know anything now. Like, he's like, I have no idea who did it. Whereas Mamie's like, oh, I know what happened. And so, you know, this idea that maybe we'll get 1980s Lucy and we'll see her selling her kid or something like that. Or she needed to have been told that in order to deliver that scene where she says, like, the things I'd done, like, there are bad moms and then there, you know, people make mistakes, but not like this, not like what I did, is what she says. So, I mean, that's my current theory. We'll see if another behind the scenes photos just like obliterates it before the next episode. But, that's where we are. Is there anything else, you want to mention before we sign off?
No, I think that that's a good theory. I think you've convinced me.
All right. Well, RIP the Grouper Street Kids.
No.
That's for sure. And, you know, just to say, where can people find your work until we meet again?
On VF.com, we just had a big rollout of the a thing we did for the kind of in conjunction with the 25th Hollywood issue, which is the most influential movie scenes from 1995 on. 1995 was the first year of the Hollywood issue, and I contributed, you contributed, we got quotes from a lot of people who were in those scenes or directed those scenes. So that's the plug. I know it's not True Detective related, but it's actually not even TV related, but we're proud of it. It looks great. And
looks amazing. Yeah.
You can find me there. You can find me on Twitter at Rylaws, and you can find me playing with Steven Dorff's dogs.
Yeah. Richard and our other film critic, Cam Collins, did an incredible job with that piece. So if you haven't checked out yet, please do. It looks incredible. You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Joy Wrote This, or you will find me in bed with the entire Hayes family reading The Jungle Book.
I would read a book in bed with Ray Fisher.
Excellent. This episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez, and we will see you all next week.
Have you sat back over the last 2 decades and thought about the sheer number of fatalities surrounding this case?
Can I tell you a secret?
That you've been killed.
What happened?
Those kids. Our kids. My whole brain's a bunch of missing pieces. That's when it all started. Panic.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.